Good morning and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center conference call. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. Welcome also to our first Zoom video conference. Those of you who know me know that I'm slightly technology averse, but it was time to join the 21st century. I owe our Senior Research Associate, Michael Johnson, a debt of gratitude for applying the pressure and for making this work. I am excited about today's call. Our guest, Arsen Ostrovsky, joins us from Israel to talk about the application of Israeli sovereignty to parts of Judea and Samaria. Before I turn the microphone over to Arsen, I want to introduce our new listeners to the JPC and to our work. We are a 501c3 organization providing perspectives and analysis of foreign and domestic policy by leading scholars, academics, and commentators. We support a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel from anyone who would deny it. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, energy security, fiscal responsibility, as well as free speech and intellectual diversity. A reminder as we move on to our program, your microphones are muted, but you can ask questions. If you have a question in the course of the conversation, please send it to our info line. That's info@jewishpolicycenter.org, info@jewishpolicycenter.org. And now I'm pleased to introduce our guest, Arsen Ostrovsky. Arsen is a leading international human rights lawyer, a political analyst, commentator, focusing on the Middle East and Israel. He has testified and spoken in support of Israel before the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, a place I hope never to find myself, the UN in New York, the European Parliament, more of my least favorite places. He's a braver man than I am. And the Knesset and various capitals in Europe and around the world. He is an expert on anti-Semitism, BDS, delegitimization of Israel, as well as on digital diplomacy, international law, the UN, and Middle East foreign policy. He's been published everywhere you would expect him to be published, in the United States, in the UK, in Australia, in India, and in Canada. And my favorite in his bio was that Arsen has been awarded, one of the 25 most influential people on Jewish Twitter by the Jewish Telegraphic Agency in recognition of his expertise in leadership in the field of digital diplomacy, Israel advocacy online. If you don't follow him, you should. If you don't do Twitter, you should do that too. If you do Twitter, follow Arsen. He is currently also, because he doesn't have enough other jobs, the executive director of the Israel Jewish Congress, an Israeli-based NGO supporting Israel around the world and working with Jewish communities and pro-Israel allies, especially in Europe. Questions, send them to info@jewishpolicycenter.org. Arsen, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Shoshana, for that very kind introduction. I can assure you that Geneva is a beautiful place. So the UN Human Rights Council inside there, perhaps a little bit less. So Geneva is lovely, especially this time of the year. Look, thank you for the overly kind introduction. And thank you especially for this invitation and everything that that you do, that the center does in terms of advocating for Israel, in terms of championing a strong U.S.-Israel alliance. That's something that's tremendously appreciated, and to everyone coming in onto this call for everything that they do as well in order to support this mission in these, you know, rather toxic, difficult, challenging, perhaps, days, maybe an understatement. It's certainly sometimes seen as an even braver step. So in that regard, it's certainly something that's deeply felt and appreciated here in Israel, and certainly something that's needed and will be needed even more so in the period, days, weeks, months. So thank you for that. Literally just before I logged into Zoom, you mentioned Twitter, I look at my Twitter feed, and one of the first things that came up is that as we're about to go on, there was a breaking news that Ambassador David Friedman and Avi Berkovitz, who's the new Jason Greenblatt in terms of managing the peace process today, that they're on their way to Jerusalem. So the meetings at the White House had finished literally just now, and they are flying back. So there's no final agreement, final decision from the US side. at this moment. What that means, it's open to interpretation. I believe there are some, I don't necessarily believe that it's a setback, but there are obviously, as you can imagine, this is a very sensitive, very difficult issue. So I suspect they're coming back here in order to finalize the remaining steps. But that is something that that we will see and learn more about in the coming days. So that's the very last thing, because I saw, because we heard the statement from Kellyanne Conway just the other day, saying that we should expect a big statement. Mind you, it was never said when that big statement shall come, just that it will come. So in that regard, we have to watch this space. So that's a little bit of logistical information, so to speak. Before I sort of, and I know you, there are a lot of questions at the end, so I want to try and leave, to be honest, as much time for that as I can. And if I'm going too long, by all means, please cut me off, as I know that a lot of the issues will be, we can develop further in the Q&A at the end. But I must say, what I love most about this particular webinar, or Zoom session, is the very title of it. The very title of it, The Application of Israeli Sovereignty, which is something that you hit the nail in the coffin right there. Because we keep hearing the word annexation, annexation, annexation. It's as if that is the only word in the vocabulary that exists. And this is something that goes to the very core of what we're dealing with, because what we are fighting for is a war of narratives right now, where words matter, where words shape opinions and people's perceptions, and they influence policy. And that's something really crucial. So the word annexation is not just factually and legally wrong, but it's something that I think people, whether they use it out of a sense of naivety or misunderstanding what it actually connotes, is one thing. But there's also, I believe, a sense of perhaps people that really truly do understand what it does mean, but use it in some kind of malice, to imply some kind of like nefarious plot. Because when you look at what is annexation at the end of the day, annexation is simply means, and I quote here from the law books, one state imposing legal authority over the territory of another state that was acquired by the use of force or aggression, normally during war. That is not the case here. Let me break it up very quickly, because this is something that I believe that really goes to the very core and very heart of what we're dealing with here. When you're looking at this, why this is not annexation, because you cannot annex something that is, one, already yours, two, to which you're legally entitled, three, which has legally been designated to you, and four, which has never actually belonged to the state of Palestine or an entity such as the state of Palestine. We keep hearing a lot about the UN Charter, about the Security Council Resolution 242, which is really the backbone of the whole Middle East negotiations process, about the Rome Statute of the ICC. Now, if we want to talk about Russia's annexation of Crimea, yes. Turkey's invasion of Cyprus, absolutely. Those can fall within the ICC under the crimes of aggression. But not when we're talking about the situation here in Israel and what Israel is proposing to do with respect to Judea and Samaria, for three very simple reasons. One, the law talks about territory acquired by force. The territory that Israel reunited in Judea and Samaria, Jerusalem for that matter, the Golan Heights in 1967, but was not an act of aggression. It was a defensive act in which Israel was forced to fight in 1967 for its very survival. So it wasn't an offensive war, which is something that the law is, or offensive action, which is something that the law is very clear about. It also talks about, you know, the land being taken from another state. Again, in 1967, there was no state of Palestine. Indeed, as today, in 2020, notwithstanding the Palestinian Authority declarations, there is no state of Palestine under the international law. That is critical. And the third point, perhaps, which I think is crucial and most important here, and something for us to bear in mind, it negates the Jewish people's very connection to the land of Judea and Samaria, a connection that is rooted not only in historical rights, but also in legal rights, which is something very important. Just last month, or in April, sorry, it was 100 years since we marked the Balfour Declaration. The San Remo resolution 100 years. So what San Remo did was, for the very first time 100 years ago, it codified Jewish rights into international legal rights. It was the Allied powers, the winning powers, that came together. We then saw the Balfour Declaration. So the Balfour Declaration was just prior to that, my apologies, in 1917, which built on that and called for a Jewish national homeland. We then saw the Mandate for Palestine, which again built on this terminology. And of course, the UN Partition Plan, again, reiterating a Jewish national homeland. So these rights which Israel has are rooted not only in historical rights, but also in legal rights, which is something very important. So you cannot say, I don't believe you, that Israel is annexing something that is yours at the end of the day, and that to which you have a legal claim, and that which has never belonged to a Palestinian state. The correct terminology is exactly as you phrased it in the title of this webinar, applying Israel's sovereignty, which is exactly what Israel is doing, which is exactly what Menachem Begin did in 1981 in the Golan Heights, when there was a tumultuous debate in the Knesset. And he said, hold on, this is not annexation. This is Israel applying Israeli law to the Golan Heights, which is an inextricable part of Israel. So that is something, an historical part of Israel. So that is something that's, I think, incredibly important and something to bear in mind, because at the end of the day, this is at the root of it, the very issue, the very narrative that we're fighting for Israel's and the Jewish people's legitimate rights in Judea and Samaria, or the West Bank and the Jordan Valley. So my apologies if I went perhaps a little bit too far into that. Happy to develop further. But at the end of the day, that is, I think, critical, because unless we can understand the context, the words, the narrative, then we're on a downhill trajectory. And at the end of the day, we are fighting for people's opinions and perceptions and to influence policies. So unless you're doing it from a proper place, then it's very difficult to make the case, I think, in a powerful and a forceful and a passionate manner. With that aside, I wanted to talk a little bit more about about the specifics in terms of what we might expect, what we might not expect, what's motivating Israel's Israeli leadership's actions, and what we might expect from the US and, of course, from the world. And there's no shortage of actors and players in this who are not lacking of opinions, we can say, and this is something that's only going to heat up as we get closer and closer to the 1st of July. I should say also, there's this magical focus on July 1. July 1st is not some kind of deadline. July 1st is only what Israel said, that Netanyahu said, that is the earliest date by which any decision or process will be made. There's a lot of reasons for that, and we can talk about it, you know, sort of in terms of timing and something. I think it's why it'll be, if it does happen, it'll be closer to July 1st than, say, November, when the elections happen, which is something that, of course, is a big part of it. So in terms of why now, everyone's asking, well, why now? Why not wait? Why didn't you do it before? Why now? A few points here. Number one, this has been a major promise of Netanyahu, certainly in the course of the three elections we had in the last year. In case you missed, we had a few elections in the last 12 months, so there's certainly an important ideological and campaign promise of his one. Netanyahu has managed to get Jerusalem recognition, Golan Heights recognition, and certainly significant rollback on the Iran deal. He wants Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, as his legacy, as the final sort of piece of his legacy. One, especially if he will, as part of the agreement with Benny Gantz, this coalition agreement, that in 18 months or so he will step down. He can step down with this, having achieved this. On the other hand, should there be another election, which is entirely possible, I'm taking a very deep breath here, but it's entirely possible, and if not in the coming foreseeable 18 months or so, then certainly after that, he can also go back to this and say, I did it. I promised that, and I gave it to him. So that's something that's playing heavily on the mind. Equally importantly, you have elections coming up in America in November. There's congressional elections as well, but certainly the big one for the White House, November. There is a chance, a real chance, that Biden might win. If Biden wins, you can imagine this will be off the table. That's not going to be, there won't be much argument about that. The closer you get to November, the more a nuisance this will become. So I suspect that from a US administration perspective, if this is going to happen, it'll happen sooner instead of something later, closer to November. Closer it gets to November, the less likely it's going to happen. We've seen the Trump vision for peace, the peace plan, the big peace plan, finally about a month or so ago, where we finally saw a very detailed, very extensive plan. This also forms a very big part of it, where they talk about it. And something also that Secretary Pompeo has spoken about a number of times, really changing the whole paradigm of how the US is looking at the settlements, especially after 2334, the UN Security Council resolution in the dying days of the Obama administration, where they actually managed to support passing the vote, saying that the settlements are illegal. So this is trying to sort of roll that back as well, which step by step the Trump administration has done by saying that the settlements are not illegal, meaning there's enough wiggle room and scope and space for the US to act and say, well, they're not illegal. Doesn't necessarily mean they are, but they're not illegal, meaning that Israel also has a right to act. And this is something that Pompeo has reiterated again just 24 hours or so ago when he was asked at a press briefing, the State Department, saying that ultimately this is a decision for Israel to make, as any democracy. That said, part of the US positioning on this and part of their willingness to give it a green light, so to say, to fully support this, is that Netanyahu also has the support of Benny Gantz. Now, Gantz and Ashkenazi, they've openly endorsed and so they support the Trump peace plan and everything that entails. They too have called it a historic opportunity, an historic plan. But they're far more conservative about it. They are in their first terms as politicians. They're both former chiefs of the defense forces here as well. So they're a lot more cautious. They don't wish to jeopardize Israel's relations with Jordan and Egypt, the two major regional players. Not that Netanyahu does, but this is certainly a very primary focus of theirs. They've also said that they will not support any plan which incorporates Palestinian or significant Palestinian populations. And they've also added that they will support it on the assumption or a proposition that it's part of a broader regional peace plan initiative. What exactly that last part means is a little bit difficult, because right now the only peace plan and real peace plan on the table is from the Trump administration. Israel has very, obviously, as we know, secret these days, blooming positive relations with a lot of the Arab and Gulf states, and we can talk about likely drawbacks and responses from them. But there is no immediate, the only peace plan to speak of right now is what the Trump administration has put forward in the vision. In terms of the Israeli sort of, perspective here, in terms of, I'm talking about outside the political sphere, two Jews and how many opinions you have for two Israelis, you can multiply that by another two or three people. At the end of the day, over the years, Israel and Israeli people, I think, have moved on. There's a recognition these days, one, that at the end of the day, we don't have a real peace partner, but also that a lot of these settlements, communities like Ariel, Male Adumim, Afrat, a lot of them, they're part of Israel. These are communities of tens of thousands of people with universities and industrial complexes. They're large communities, bigger than some cities in Israel on the other side of the within the Green Line. So there's a recognition that these are well and proper parts of Israel, and that they will remain, importantly, part of Israel under any agreement, under any peace plan. The issue becomes, I suppose, and certainly from Gantz and Ashkenazi's perspective, is Even though there might be an acceptance of these communities and territories, the question becomes more strategic. How do you move forward? How do you implement the plan? The plan is seen from the Trump administration talks about future Palestinian state, roughly on 70% or so of the West Bank territory. So we're talking about, if Israel does apply sovereignty, we're talking about give or take about 30%, okay? That said, and I think you can also gauge a little bit from the fact that Friedman and Berkowitz are coming back a little bit earlier or unplanned, the fact that there is no concrete agreement as yet, there's still a lot of trepidation. Certainly from Israel's perspective, this is a big step in any which way. For all intents and purposes, Prime Minister Netanyahu is a very conservative leader. I mean, small c conservative. He's very mindful of keeping the status quo, of not rocking the boat too much as well. But they're also looking at this as a historic opportunity. Something ahead of the US election, as something that, in terms of the very symbolism of it, in terms of the power of it, of finally acknowledging that these communities are part of the Jewish state. It gives an opportunity, like I said, to roll back 2334, the resolution passed in the dying days of the US Obama administration. It's a recognition that Israel cannot wait forever for the Palestinians to come to the table, which is ultimately why I believe that the Trump administration will give their approval, so to speak, to this, because they will say, and I would hope they would say, something along the lines of, is this ideal? No. But at the end of, does Israel have a legitimate right to this territory? Yes. But at the end of the day, we have given the Palestinians every single opportunity to come to the table, not just for this plan, which they have rejected before they even saw that, and then rejected just to be safe afterwards as well, but every single plan that came beforehand, from Camp David in 2000, in 2001, in Aqaba, in 2008, in 2009, with Ehud Olmert. As Abba Eban, the former Israeli diplomat, said, the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And this plan, for the first time, is something that gives them an actual opportunity for statehood, a path, a vision to independence. But something that was really important, I think, and if you saw the op-ed by Ambassador Ron Dermer, Israel's ambassador to the US, in the Washington Post just the other day, and he wrote that this plan finally shatters the two-state illusion and commits to a realistic two-state solution, meaning that no longer Israel's interests and security concerns will be disregarded. That no longer will our connection to this land be minimized. But most importantly, that this is a, just like Jerusalem and the Golan Heights, recognition of Israel's right to the territory, a part of the territory in Judea and Samaria, is a basic recognition of truth and fact and a foundation for peace and the future. Because unless the Palestinian leadership understands that Israel is here and is here to stay, unless the international community, including our allies and friends and partners and others in the EU and elsewhere, understand that Israel is here to stay, that there must be recognition that these territories will form part of Israel under any peace plan, that is the foundation for peace, for the future. You saw just today, or earlier today, or yesterday evening, depending on which time zone, the Palestinian leadership held a rally in Jordan Valley, which is very much also at the center whether Israel will apply sovereignty there as well. They had a rally there, and one of the quotes was from the PLO leadership, actually said that we will continue fighting until we free Palestine. They didn't say until 67 borders, or that in specific words said until Palestine will be free. What does that mean? We know what that means. It's a euphemism for the very destruction of Israel, because for them, whether it's Male Adumim or whether it's Haifa, it's all one and the same. At the end of the day, how we move forward, I think there's still a lot that remains to be seen. Everything I say to you today, you might possibly completely disregard tomorrow when we read the papers, so I apologize in advance. I suspect that it will not be the full 30% to which the sovereignty will be applied in the West Bank. I suspect it will be something more symbolic, something gradual, something phased over a period. We'll probably look at maybe a couple of the major blocks like Male Adumim, Ariel, Efrat, those that are also very close to Jerusalem, those where it's very easy to delineate the borders, which is something that's crucial, that's very important. So I suspect in the coming days we might see moves. I suspect it'll be along those lines. As you can imagine, the international community is not exactly jumping up and down for joy, fully embracing that. I know there are questions about how the international community will respond, and we can touch about that shortly as well. But we've seen the Palestinians saying everything from this will be the collapse of the PA to we will declare a Palestinian state. It's from one spectrum to complete opposite. We've had today Hamas saying that if Israel goes ahead with this, they will declare war. Because up to now, they've declared, you know, peace and utopia, because that'll somehow be different. The EU is threatening sanctions, and we can talk about that as well, because the EU will form a very important component and possible ramifications that we'll have to deal with. The UN is up in arms. The Security Council had a debate number, you can fill in the blank here, just the other day, where of course the US and Ambassador Kraft was the only voice of reason and moral leadership that stood up and spoke the truth again, following again in the footsteps of Nikki Haley. The Arab and Gulf states, which are crucial to this jigsaw puzzle again, they have spoken out, as you can imagine, not exactly jumping with joy for this, but depending on who you're looking at, with muted responses, the Jordanians have been especially vocal about this. The Egyptians, on the other hand, have been very quiet. Very quiet. Sisi has not said very much about this. The Gulf states, UAE, we saw their officials wrote a very historic op-ed in the leading Israeli paper, Yediot Ahronot, saying that if Israel goes ahead with this, it will halt, or it will push back normalization ties. And of course, we have the issue with the Democratic Party. Just today, I think some like 189 something Democrats signed a letter against the plans and calling for Israel to halt. It seems to be like a battle between the competing letters from the Democrats on the one side and the Republicans on the other side. Everyone's writing letters these days. Of everything that I just mentioned, again, we can go into detail in a few moments. I'm not so concerned. It will not be Armageddon. It will not be the end of the world. This was said to us before the US recognized Jerusalem, moved the embassy. The world did not end. The sun rose. We continued. Life went on. The one aspect of that I do have legitimate concern is with respect to Israel's relationship with the United States, and specifically with the Democrats as well. That is, I think, a cause for concern, how that is moved ahead. From Israel's perspective, certainly in the context of the US elections coming up, that's, again, something that you're probably the far greater expert than I am at. That's something we can speak about. So with that, my apologies, I went a little bit too long with what I wanted to say. I thought it was important to focus especially on the issue of annexation, the sovereignty, because that's very much goes the whole war of narratives to the battle that we're fighting. But happy to take, you know, any questions and continue this discussion. And again, thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for everything that you are doing, that everyone on this call is doing. So I'll leave it in your hands next.
Okay, I accept. First, let me thank you. This was a major piece of our education. You're right. We have been calling it the application of sovereignty. I don't think people are focused very much on why that's important and what the alternative is. You can see in the Democrat letter on the Hill, they refer to annexation only. Chuck Schumer said it in an interview. Susan Rice said it in an interview, annexations. There's a difference, though, it seems to me, between the wording you use and the fundamental principle. The Democratic Party or the Democrats in Congress are telling Israel, don't. Here's what we want from you. We want you to not. The president's position and that of the letter on the Republican side is we will support Israel in what Israel chooses. Do Israelis see that as a big difference?
Some do. You know, I think the Republican letter from the House was just a few days ago. So we had the letter from the Senate led by Ted Cruz and a number of other Republican senators. And a few days before that, the letter from the House. The letter from the House, very interesting. It didn't even talk about Judea and Samaria. It didn't talk about the West Bank. It didn't talk about what Israel will do. The very first paragraph of that letter was them saying that we respect Israel's right as a sovereign democratic nation to make the decisions it feels is appropriate, which is something that's very crucial. Is it noticed? It is noticed. But at the end of the day, I think from an Israeli perspective, people are looking at it as probably going over it, seeing as two sides that are drawing their lines in the sand, essentially, irrespective of terminology or the way it's being phrased or the very reasonable manner in which the Republican letter, for example, went ahead and said, you know what, Israel will do what Israel believes is right. They're a democracy. We believe in the Trump vision for peace. We recognize that the Palestinians have been given chance after chance after chance, but they have not come to the table. Not only have they not come to the table, they have continued to incite and use terror. It is a, you know, it's a very important difference. So it's difficult. Israelis, I think, do notice the difference, but at the end of the day, what they see is, in all honesty, is two sides that have drawn the line. The Democrats are against, the Republicans are for.
Thank you. So let's talk about some of your neighbors. We did an interview recently with a retired Israeli general of some importance, and we talked about the Arab street and how Arab leadership responds to its own populations, especially in the last couple of years, because so many of them have disappeared and fallen under unpleasant circumstances. He said that he believed that the issue of Palestine, in quotes, resonates greatly with Arab populations, perhaps even more than Jerusalem, with them. Would you agree with that as an assessment?
No, actually, I wouldn't. There you go again, two Jews and how many opinions. Resonates, yes. Resonates greatly, no. If anything, I think the Palestinian issue has gone down and down and down in terms of priorities. You see that, for example, in the way that Israel is being very openly, if not necessarily fully embraced, we've got a little bit of time to go to that, but the way the Gulf states are openly acknowledging their relations with Israel, something that was very much under the radar before and very much above the table now. We see, and this is why I don't think that there will be a rupture in relations with the Gulf and Arab countries, because at the end of the day, Iran is the primary concern for them. And in as much as the Palestinian issue might be on their agenda, and if Israel goes ahead with the sovereignty, it will be perhaps a nuisance, but at the end of the day, when they're talking about Iran, it's an existential issue for them. Well, maybe not as much as Israel, but for them as well. So Iran will be the primary concern for them, and this will not change that. They also understand the importance of maintaining strong relations with the U.S. administration, with the Trump administration, especially. We've seen the Gulf countries openly, you know, becoming closer and closer to Israel. As I, you know, noted a little bit before as well, Egypt, interestingly, has not said anything. Well, they have, but they've been quite muted, relatively speaking. Jordan has spoken out and quite vocally about it. But from Jordan's perspective, and by the way, they spoke out very, very loudly before Jerusalem as well. Jerusalem was a red line, they said. And sort of, you know, how many red lines can there be? Jerusalem was a red line. We survived. At the end of the day, they need the peace with Israel. The peace treaty will not be, I don't believe it will be ripped up. They need the security with Israel. I believe for a lot of them, the statements we're saying are for domestic consumption, for the people on the street, for whom they need to be seen as, on the one hand, showing that there is some solidarity, of course, with Palestinian people, but also, on the other hand, for them to perhaps, as in maybe Jordan's case, to divert attention from some of the domestic issues. So we'll see the usual, I think, from the Arab League and the likes, condemnation that we do not support this. This will go to the UN. This will affect our relations. But at the end of the day, I think this will just be a process by which they'll go through sort of the usual steps, but it won't dramatically affect on the ground.
Thank you. So we have a question from a listener. EU statements, EU proclamations have to be unanimous, otherwise they don't exist. There appears to be a division in the EU among the countries, not exactly, but it kind of works out that the countries that used to be called Central Europe, post-communist countries, tend to be more pro-Israel than Western European countries. And there seems to be a little nucleus of people at the EU preventing unanimous statements. Could you talk about your European friends?
Sure. It's interesting to say European friends, because we often talk about, so when it comes to Israel, as lost cause. I don't look at it that way. Israel, I think, certainly has many friends in Europe. And again, similar like America, we've seen the battle of letters as well in Europe. Parliamentarians saying, no, this cannot happen. There needs to be sanctions if it does. And then we've seen also European parliamentarians saying, Israel's a democracy, we support their right, and so on. Look, there is a divide within Europe, within the EU. EU works by consensus. There's 27 nations. There were 28 with the UK. There's 27 nations now. They do not have consensus on this issue, on Israel in general, to be quite frank. It's not only the Central Eastern European nations, which you mentioned, the Visegrad countries, Hungary especially. Hungary's been leading the effort, saying that we will support Israel at the UN, at the international forums, at the International Criminal Court, and so on. They've been the most vocal. But also we've seen in recent period Austria as well, very crucial, because Austria is not a Central Eastern European nation, it's a Western nation. It also has a very young, charismatic, conservative leader in Sebastian Kurz. So Austria has very much, I think, been also at the head of this effort. And remember, Austria said that, you know, we don't support necessarily the settlement enterprise. We believe in two-state solution. But you know what? We also stand with Israel, and we don't believe in singling out Israel, and certainly not at this stage when the EU wanted to threaten Israel with sanctions before any decision has actually been made. So yes, it does work by consensus, and that certainly applies in respect of the more egregious punitive measures. And there have been a number of states that have called for that. Luxembourg has been leading this effort. Belgium, Sweden, a number of other nations have supported that call. Germany has been a little bit different. Germany is not so pleased with this move, and Heiko Maas, the foreign minister, is actually in Israel. They certainly don't believe it advances peace. They're very much advocating a two-state solution. But given the very unique nature of our relations with Germany, I don't believe they would actually support any punitive measures or sanctions against Israel. France, I should add, is another part of the bloc of nations that is actively pushing for stronger response. So Europe is very much mixed from supporting Israel, mixed to pushing for sanctions, mixed to saying that we might not necessarily support this, but at the same time, we haven't seen anything at this stage, so we have to wait and see. So on the one hand, that's a positive. On the other hand, the EU can take a number of other steps which can be quite problematic and worrisome for Israel. You have the Horizon 2020 initiative, which is a major, major research science initiative of the EU, to which Israel is a partner, to which there's a substantial amount of funding. One can argue whether they will or not, because they understand, I believe, I would hope in any case, that they have so much to gain out of Israeli research, science and innovation that they would not want to jeopardize that. They can take a number of other steps from labeling. You can see individual states, for example, They can take whatever steps they wish to take. And we've already heard a number of countries saying that if Israel goes ahead with this, they will recognize a Palestinian state. What this means in the big scheme of things, it's questionable because there's, I don't know, 100 how many states have already recognized Palestinian state. That hasn't got us any further in the peace process. It could affect Israel's bilateral relations. That's possible. They could individually apply sanctions or bills. In Ireland, there's been a debate, which has sort of been put on hold for the time being, about criminalizing any involvement in Judea and Samaria, so that if an Irish person buys something in the occupied territory or in the old city of Jerusalem, for example, they may be susceptible to criminal charges. So there's a lot of individual steps that can be taken, but the most punitive, the most serious, egregious measures that for the EU to take, they need consensus, and right now they do not have any consensus on how to act and how to move.
Thank you. So we have a couple of minutes left, and I would like to focus it on the people that nobody talks about, and that would be the Palestinians who live in Judea and Samaria. Question from a listener: how will this actually impact the lives of Palestinians who live in areas that will have Israeli sovereignty applied to them? What does it mean to them, if anything? How different will their lives be?
That's a great question. You know, I think we can also, if I can strap quote on that, it'll change, I think, the this isn't just a wouldn't just be a symbolical act, although very powerful act symbolically, but it is also a practical act, not just for the Palestinians, but also for the Israeli people that live in these communities. From the Israeli perspective, at the moment, I'm talking about Area C, which is where which is what Israel controls, with Area C and then A and B. A and B is governed to various extents by the Palestinian Authority. Area C is by the by Israel, but specifically by the military, by the IDF. So by applying Israeli sovereignty and Israeli law, Israeli domestic law, you remove the IDF bureaucracy. Anyone that knows anything about Israel, even if they don't know about Israel, they know that bureaucracy in itself is a massive, massive issue. And that, you know, not to be underplayed when you want to, when you're talking about from buying property to insurance to employment and so on, this will have a very practical effect on those Israelis living in Area C by removing that, a lot of that red tape, a lot of that barrier, by applying Israeli domestic law, which at the moment in that area, you have this archaic mix of some Israeli law, you have law, remnants from the Ottoman Empire, from the British Mandate, and from Israel proper today. So from the Israeli perspective, definitely will assist and will make the Israeli lives a lot easier. From the Palestinian perspective, on the one hand, I don't believe that this will have a major impact. And something that the Israelis have made very clear is that they have no intention of applying sovereignty to those parts of the West Bank where there are, or at least considerable, Palestinian communities. And you hear a lot of commentators similar today saying that if Israel goes ahead with this, it will be apartheid, it will be a one-state solution. That couldn't be further from the truth. And also, one step further, I actually believe that something that's used today as a alarmism to try and put pressure on Israel not to act, nothing of the like, because Israel would delineate the borders, I believe, around those Palestinian communities, you know, meaning that they would continue more or less under current sort of status quo, that they will not become part of the Israeli domestic law, that their lives will more or less continue in the immediate term as they are. But the issue is long-term, and long-term, if you consider this peace plan or this action is a foundation for the future, a recognition that Israel will remain in these communities and that this is actually a building block to peace, a recognition of the basic fact and reality on the ground. In the long term, this is something that can only benefit not just Israeli, but the Palestinians in the Judea and Samaria, in the West Bank, including in Area C, which I think is about 500,000, 600,000 Jews or Israelis living there. We don't know the full official figures because, as you can imagine, there's a lot of politics, even with that side from a Palestinian perspective, but it's certainly a much, much lower figure, maybe half of that. But the sovereignty we're talking about is to the large blocks like Mala Demim, Ariel, to the Frat, that are predominantly, if not exclusively, already with the Israelis.
So I could do this all afternoon. I don't know if you could, but our listeners are always promised an out at 12:45. And so we are going to have to call this to a close. Thank you very much for enlightening us. I do believe that anybody who's on this call today has a much better picture of what Israel is doing, why they're doing it, and what the Israeli government expects to have come out of this. For that, we thank you, and we hope you'll come back.
We would love to. Thank you. And again, thank you for all that you're doing. So that's definitely something appreciated and felt.
It's our pleasure.